From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, an MIT MacArthur Genius winner on how her unexpected cancer diagnosis inspired her to bring artificial intelligence and machine learning to oncology.
But what was even more unexpected was how little data and machine learning are used in oncology. I mean, I haven't seen any.
Also today, drinking, sexual assault, racism. American fraternities were once founded on gentlemanly codes of honor and service, but Boston journalist John Hechinger says fraternities now face an existential choice.
Change is really the only answer. Otherwise, you're just going to get these episodes again. You're going to shut them down. You know, I'm not sure there's really any other way but to try to just reduce drinking and make slow, steady improvement.
And Sox manager John Farrell is out.
John did a nice job for us. We won divisions with him, won World Championship. So he's a good baseball man.
We'll talk about it coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll start today with a genius. Well, a so-called MacArthur genius, because the MacArthur Foundation announced its 2017 fellows today, a group of 24 painters, anthropologists, mathematicians, and more, who've each been given a $625,000 award for their social, political, and scientific contributions to the nation. Now, one of those winners is Regina Barzilai. She's a professor of computer science and a leading researcher in machine learning and natural language processing. She's also now working on applying artificial intelligence to cancer research, and she joins us. Welcome to Radio Boston, and congratulations.
Thank you, and hi.
So, first of all, how does it feel to be a so-called MacArthur Genius winner?
I'm still processing it, so maybe I would have a better idea in a few days from now. Now it feels like kind of really, really busy and surprising. I got notified about it exactly a month before,
yeah. And
I was not allowed to tell two people about it. And I kind of felt it was imaginary friend in my head. It was funny, you know, to keep it secret. I was not sure if it's true or not true.
Yeah.
And I got used to live with it. But what happens in the last day is totally different from whatever I ever experienced in my life.
Did you have to keep it secret from everyone, even at CISO?
Yeah. So they allowed me to say it only to one person.
Oh, and you could choose who that person was?
I could choose person, right. Assuming that this person was very discreet. So I selected one person.
Okay. May I ask who that person was?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a student who became dear friend who is currently undergoing treatment for cancer. And the reason I felt I absolutely have to tell her because I felt that people who are in this condition, they really need to know that there are great things that come after. And even though it doesn't look like it to you now, you would actually feel it later. And I felt that by sharing it, it will give, you know, some glimpse of great things that will come for her.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful. So you know, in a minute or two, we'll talk more about how your research applies to cancer research. But I want to actually step back a little because you've been doing very cutting-edge research in artificial intelligence for quite some time, specifically machine learning, right?
And natural language processing.
Natural language processing. So how did you get interested in natural language processing?
So it was actually interesting development. I started my master's thesis in Israel. And at the time, in Israel and everywhere else, you know, AI was really in a preliminary stages. And everything, all the tools that we see today that, you know, millions of people are using were totally non-existent then. It was like either you have machine translation system working or flying to the moon. It was in the same, you know, science fiction kind of realm. And what was interesting, I remember I started looking at possible topics for my master's thesis, and I thought, wow, there is really not much there. You can just go in and try stuff, and it's exciting. You know, there is so much place to invent new things.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into it. Yeah.
So when we say natural language processing, maybe we should just take a minute to define what that means. Is that a computer's ability to understand human spoken language or analyze it or what? Because, I mean, right now we're living in a world where I think people are basically with their phones are talking. They are talking to computers all the time. So what do you mean?
So what typically people mean in the field is actually machines that can perform useful tasks with language. For instance, to translate the document.
I see.
We cannot really say that the machine understands the document the same way as we understand the document, but it can translate it, or it can take a long document and summarize it, or it can predict the sentiment of a review. So those are very practical applications. Or even when you are having a request for your Alexa or any other tool you're using, when you're making a request, machine can translate it into some specific action.
Yeah. So in the years of your research on natural language processing, what did you find that machines or computers could do better in this field than humans? Or is that even the right kind of question to ask?
I think it is actually the very correct question to ask, and it's a very relevant question today, because people kind of have the feeling, because, you know, your Alexa understands you, and you can take Google Translate and translate from Japanese, and you don't speak Japanese, you start having feeling that, you know, maybe it can do everything and write you poetry tomorrow. So machines are really good in solving tasks for which they are provided large amounts of annotated data. And what I mean by that, like, for instance, if you're looking at something like Alexa, you can, Alexa understands your request, I don't know, to call Uber, because maybe somebody provided a corpus where thousands of people ask for Uber in different ways. It doesn't mean that the request 1001 has to be the same as what it's seen, but it knows how to generalize and identify the pattern and then categorize your request accordingly.
I see. And what is it that so far the machines or the computers have had difficulty doing?
One of the biggest difficulties is that if you want to try your tool in the area which is different from what you had your training data in, machines typically, their accuracy goes significantly down. If you train your machine to predict sentiment for reviews from one website, and let's say there is another website which is more formal or more colloquial, we expect that the accuracy will go down. And furthermore, you know, the human that, you know, knows how to read reviews, he may show, you know, several different products, and they would be able to generalize to all possible products. So for machine to go from one domain to another without training examples is really difficult.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your very recent and current research, because it has to do with oncology and cancer research. And first, let me just ask you, you have personal experience with this, right?
Yeah. So in 2014, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was the first one in my family to have any form of cancer. And it was a routine mammogram. You know, unexpected is just understatement. I couldn't even imagine. But what was even more unexpected was how little data and machine learning are used in oncology. I mean, I would say I haven't seen any. And I was treated in an excellent place at MGH. And I don't think that MGH is an exception. It's actually true from what I understood, you know, across the country, that today we are not using at all data in order to select treatment, to personalize it, or to help the patients to reduce their uncertainty about the outcomes. And I really strongly felt it has to be changed.
But changed how? Because one would think that actually, you know, now that you describe it, it's a big surprise, because medicine, and modern medicine, ideally is awash in data, right? Like every step of the way, doctors and medical teams are collecting data about you and your treatment.
Yeah, but this data is exactly collected and used in a way which assumes that there is a human in a loop who would analyze it. The data in medicine is collected for human readers, is the way it is currently collected. And there is a very little effort to actually fully structure and automate it.
Well, there's some practical examples then we could talk about in terms of how data could really have an impact on oncology. Mammograms. For example, I've read that you're developing or have developed some new technologies that would allow machines to possibly read mammograms more accurately than radiologists.
So my interest is, you know, we're working on doing the reading part, and you know, there is more progress to be made. And we're working very closely with the head of breast radiology at MGH, Dr. Connie Lehman. But the questions are both of interest to her and to me are to do things that currently doctors cannot do. For instance, we know from, you know, biology that cancer doesn't grow from today to tomorrow. So it actually takes a lot of time until the tissue develops, and it takes even longer time until you can actually see the tumor on the mammogram. But there are changes in the tissue that are happening for a long time. So can machine detect that currently the patient undergoes these changes even before it is visible, and how early you can do it? Naturally, for breast cancer, there are things that you can do to the patient if you know that they are really on the way towards, you know, bad outcomes. And these things are currently not done. There are lots of papers which would look at certain features and say, if we're looking back at your mammogram, there is certain things that could have been maybe seen, but it's not very deterministic patterns. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly why you need to have a machine which can look at this huge collection and identify which changes are normal changes associated with aging and which changes are really very early signs of us heading in a wrong direction.
It sounds like you love this work.
Very much.
And do you know what you're going to do with the $600,000 or so?
To tell you the truth, I didn't even have time to think about it. The whole month, I was half in the mind that it was a hoax. And I shouldn't put any high hopes on this event. And since it actually became public, my life became like totally crazy. So once the craze will calm down, I will start thinking about it.
And that student to whom you shared the news, who's currently undergoing treatment for cancer.
She just actually finished.
She finished. Okay. So did she feel the hope that you were hoping?
I think that she was excited that I was shared it with her. And she actually contributes and works actively on some of these projects. And we all, I don't know if the MacArthur thing did it for her, but I think it was important to her to see that there are great things to come, and I hope she saw it. Yeah. I just saw her yesterday during her last treatment.
Great. Well, Regina Barzilai is a computer science professor at MIT. She researches natural language processing, machine learning, and she's applying that now to the world of oncology. She's also an official winner of the 2017 MacArthur Foundation Genius Award. Thank you so much, and congratulations once again.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in 2015, Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity brothers at the University of Oklahoma were caught on a cell phone singing this awful racist song.
There'll never be a sing. There'll never be a sing. You're hanging from a tree, but it'll never stop with me. There'll never be a sing.
Well, yeah, what you heard is what you heard. They used the N-word, they sang about lynching, and it really shocked the nation. But it wasn't just a one-off act of racism among drunken fraternity brothers. In his new book, reporter John Hechinger writes about the long history of racism at SAE, and he goes even further. SAE is one among many fraternities on college campuses across the country, and with each additional story of racist behavior, of sexual assault, hazing, and even death at the fraternities, Hechinger says the Greek system comes closer to facing an existential choice. Fraternities can perpetuate the ugliest chapters of American history, he writes, or they can turn the page and once again reflect the country's highest aspirations. Hechinger's new book is True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of American Fraternities, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna. Appreciate it.
So first of all, let me just get some full disclosure out of the way. Are you a member of any fraternity, or have you been?
I was not a member of a fraternity.
Okay. So then why did you decide to write this very long and in-depth book of exploration of SAE and Greek life in general in the United States?
Well, I'd worked on a series of stories at Bloomberg News where we looked at fraternity deaths. And when I finished, I felt like I hadn't quite gotten to the heart of the story. And I was fascinated by a kind of dichotomy in Greek life that you have these organizations that espouse these high ideals of friendship and honor and integrity, and then you have these horrifying series of deaths and sexual assaults and racist episodes. And I wanted to understand, you know, why they're actually more popular than they've ever been.
Yeah. I mean, you write how there's a chasm. That's your word, a chasm between their foundational values and what they purport to teach members versus what all the news stories have been covering. Which, by the way, you do point out interestingly, I think, that we're learning more about what goes on inside fraternity houses in the social media age than perhaps we ever knew before. But let me ask you, why SAE then?
Well, when we did our series, SAE had more deaths than any other fraternity. Mm-hmm. So that was my starting point. But also, it's been at the center of every scandal in fraternity life. You mentioned the video at University of Oklahoma. It also was featured in the Hunting Ground documentary where women said its initials stand for sexual assault expected. But the other reason I focused on SAE is I found that there were people within the fraternity, top executives, who were very, very worried about the future and wanted to change. So as a main character for this book, it's really interesting. It's a kind of self-exploration. And I found that, you know, they were quite cooperative and kind of eager for me to figure out what the truth is and the way forward.
Okay, interesting. Well, on that note, before we sort of dive into the history of SAE, which you illuminate in the book, I just want to turn to listeners and just give a shout out for anyone out there. I mean, if you're a member of a fraternity or a sorority, or specifically if you're an SAE member or former member, what do you make of this idea that John Hechinger puts forth in his new book that there's this chasm between the values that Greek life are supposed to be teaching young people versus how they actually experience Greek life, and also how do you close that chasm if you believe that it exists? I mean, is banning fraternities an answer, or is there a better way forward? I mean, when all the news stories are about drinking, sexual assault, racism, are we missing something here? And if so, how would we get to a better place with Greek life on American campuses? So call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with your thoughts or questions. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, John, I started out with that tape from the University of Oklahoma because, I mean, it was a shocking, very public action that got a lot of people to pay attention again to SAE, but also because in your book, you talk about the founding of the fraternity and how maybe if we looked at how it was founded, we shouldn't be so shocked, right? Because you say SAE claims the distinction of being the only continually operating general fraternity founded in the antebellum South to survive the Civil War. So how was this fraternity created?
Well, it's founded at the University of Alabama in 1856, and its members were its early members fought in the Confederacy. But I should say that they are in some ways typical of the traditional fraternities, the traditionally white fraternities. It's not like any of them were very welcoming to newcomers in education. Mm-hmm. You know, they started out at a time, sort of the 19th century, when there weren't very many, there weren't any women and very few minorities. And when schools became more diverse, they typically excluded all the newcomers and treated them very poorly. And that's why we have such a divided campus today. We have historically white fraternities, historically black fraternities, women's fraternities or sororities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you write about how SAE's governing laws once were very explicit in their dictates on who could join, right? That the members, potential members, had to be from the Aryan race.
That's right. I mean, they had explicit exclusions of blacks and Jews. And that was also quite typical of historically white fraternities. There was almost a celebration of the idea of discrimination. And in the 60s and 70s, in the 50s really, and 60s, when they were under pressure to integrate, they fought against all these measures. And I came across a really interesting discussion at the fraternity where they said they were going to drop this discriminatory clause in 1951, but they were very clear that they were going to do that as a public relations move, and they were not going to accept blacks or Jews.
So what you're saying then is that SAE, which was founded, what, in 1856?
That's right.
So for a century, it was official policy that that African-American and Jews would never be admitted.
Well, it didn't need to be a policy until probably the early 20th century. When you're talking about the 19th century, I don't think people were even thinking that anyone would even join. But as soon as there were enough sort of newcomers in higher education, then it became explicit and written. And again, it's not just SAE. I looked at all sorts of fraternities had very, very similar exclusions.
Right. So, but is it fair to say, I guess I'm trying to like enter this chasm that you're talking about with you here, because is it fair to say that if by practice and then by codification, if for a century a fraternity like SAE was basically officially whites only, that even when the official designations dropped away, that there are deeper cultural habits within the fraternity that are harder to overcome when it comes to race?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, if you go to a college campus today, I mean, basically you have segregated Greek systems. You have black fraternities, white fraternities, and fraternities of all different groups. And that's really those kind of divisions are kind of, you know, they're antithetical to what most universities are trying to do. And that history is very much alive. Now, today there are members often of different races, but there are many, many fewer, yeah. Something like 3-4% of historically white fraternities are African-American.
Huh. Now, you tell the story of the founder of SAE, Noble Leslie DeVoti?
DeVoti, yes.
Who was a Confederate chaplain.
That's right.
Okay. And because you point out how he died, you say, or the apocryphal story, at least, of how he died, you say is very telling about SAE's a certain aspect of SAE's culture.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. I mean, Noble Leslie DeVoti was the valedictorian in Alabama. He was a great student. He went to Princeton Theological Seminary and became a chaplain, and in many ways represented a lot of the sort of positive qualities of the early fraternities. And he died when he fell off of a pier in a storm in Alabama, in Montgomery, Alabama, and was swept out to sea. And there's no indication that he was drunk, but it's something that a lot of the fraternity brothers like to say that, you know, is kind of a joke. And I think it's, you know, in a way it says more about sort of the attitude toward drinking today than it does about the founder.
Right. So this is going to come up again and again because as I was reading your book, I kept turning back to a paragraph where you write about basically what the organizational creed of SAE is. They have something called the True Gentleman.
That's right.
Yeah. And if I can just read part of it,
sure.
I have it right here. It's a creed where they say that a gentleman whose conduct proceeds from goodwill and an acute sense of propriety and whose self-control is equal to all emergencies, and then goes on to say, who thinks of the rights and feelings of others rather than his own. And so how does that square with something like University of Oklahoma brothers singing a song about lynching on a bus?
Well, it absolutely shouldn't. And I think that the national leadership was pretty horrified. And a lot of members elsewhere were horrified. But the problem is you had a chapter that hadn't had a black member for many, many years. And no one stamped this out. And, you know, I actually spoke to the last black member of that fraternity who had a really wonderful experience there. And his best friends were from SAE, and he was horrified and now feels totally betrayed. So, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to look at their creed and their promise is that I think, like, you know, like our Constitution, we don't always live up to it. There are people in the fraternity who believe these words and feel that they can change over time and that they could judge people more by, you know, their character rather than by, you know, race or class or any other measure.
Yeah. You know, we've got some folks who on the line who want to join us here in just a second, who are, at least I see one caller who was a former SAE. But before we get to that person, can I just take a step back here with you, John? And I just wonder, can you describe to us, I mean, how central is Greek life, or how fraternities specifically, to the social and even academic life on college campuses? I mean, we're making a presumption that they are, but are they?
Well, they are very central. They're particularly central in big public universities that really educate most Americans. And, you know, they are absolutely often subsidized by the schools. They house a quarter of a million students, more than anyone except for the universities themselves. Colleges would have to spend billions of dollars to try to figure out a way to replace them as just in terms of housing. And in schools with a decent-sized fraternity culture, you know, like I visited Indiana University or University of Alabama, they dominate the social life. They are the center of parties, and they decide, you know, who gets into the parties and how they operate. Mm. So I would say, you know, they're as central as any academic department.
Yeah. Well, we're talking with John Hechinger. His new book is True Gentlemen, The Broken Promise of America's Fraternities. He's written a very deeply researched book about Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE, as sort of an exemplar of both the promise and problems that American fraternities currently face today. And you can join us with your questions or comments. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's take a quick call here. Josh is calling from Plymouth. You're on the air, Josh.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to push back just a little bit. I am an SAE. I was active in the early 1990s, but Sigma Alpha Epsilon is something that in some way will be in my life forever. And I just think that your guest is painting not only SAE but the fraternity system with a broad brush, and doesn't seem to mention any of the wonderful things that the Greek system does bring to college campuses, including a tremendous amount of charity and benefit work. I remember whenever there were blood drives, the Greek system were always the first ones there to help, one of many examples. And another thing is, so my question is, how many sexual assaults occur on these campuses outside of the Greek system? The dorm rooms, on-campus housing? I mean, it seems like, I know it sells books to you know, really presume that all this is going on in the Greek system, but I rarely hear it mentioned happening or pointing to anything outside on campus.
Yeah.
In broad campus life.
So, Josh, hang on here for a second. Don't hang up, because I want to let John Hechinger answer, but then I've got another question for you, so hang in there. John, your response?
Well, I mean, these are important points, and I should say that in the book, I do point out that Greek organizations raise $20 million a year in philanthropy, and perhaps even more important, people form friendships for life, and I met many people who found their fraternity experience extremely meaningful, and there's research to show that it can be very beneficial. And sort of the last third of the book looks at that and looks at, can you disentangle the good from the bad? So that's a very good point. On sexual assault, the research is pretty clear. The Department of Justice statistics show that women who frequent fraternity parties are 1.5 times more likely to be victims of sexual assault, and there are other studies like that. These spaces are among the more dangerous on campus, and yes, of course, there are sexual assaults, too many all over the campus, but the environment, sort of an alcohol-soaked party environment, as one sociologist told me, makes them kind of a predictable outcome. Mm.
So, John, back to you. My question for you is, I mean, Josh. John Hechinger writes in his book that in the 5-year period between 2011 and 2016, that at least sexual assaults took place at least 15 SAE houses out of the 230 across the country. That's what was documented. And then there's this interesting note. He talks about how insurance companies have rated fraternities just above, and these are in your words, John, toxic waste dumps because That's of claims right. related to drinking, hazing, and sexual assault. So Josh from Plymouth, I just guess my question for you is, how can fraternities like SAE continue to embody those core values that you were talking about and the positives, but reduce the negative impacts of these other things which do also happen at the fraternities?
Well, I think you'd need to model it on any other large organization. Of course, in the headlines, there's been a lot of news about sexual assaults in the United States military. I hate to say it, but our own body of Congress in Washington, you should look at some of the records and some of the things that occur with our various members of Congress. I think they would raise your eyebrows. So I think that it to me, isn't an anomaly in the Greek system. I think it just represents broader trends in our society and other organizations of equal size and diversity. And when I say diversity, it may not be racial. When I was attending university, there were historically black fraternities, and the main Greek system, which certainly wasn't exclusionary, but there was kind of a divide, mm-hmm. And it's just the way it was. But, you know, back then, I guess in the quaint old 90s, no one had a real problem.
Right. Hey, Josh, I'm going to take it back from here because I want to turn back to John Hechinger. But thank you so much for your call and for your perspective. I really appreciate it. John, let's explore a little bit more this question about drinking, because alcohol is one thing that binds every chapter of your book together, practically. You seem to talk about how alcohol and fraternity culture isn't necessarily even a new phenomenon, which surprised me.
No, I mean, from the beginning, I mean, fraternities had this kind of split personality. And on the one hand, they were tended to misbehave. They tended to drink very heavily, even riot. And they were condemned by college presidents and caused a great problem. But they also added a lot to colleges. They created the kind of social life that we have in colleges today, with residential life and extracurricular activities and, you know, leadership opportunities.
But how bad is it, really?
Right now?
Yeah.
I mean, the research is incontrovertible that fraternity men are the heaviest drinkers on campus. And, you know, it's always interesting. Josh, the SAE, is often saying, well, it's just representative of the rest of the campus. But every study shows that if you're worried about binge drinking, the place you'd want to start would be in fraternities, because that's where more of the drinking is. And of course, other people do it. But I mean, I guess I would respond the way that a lot of the national leaders of SAE responded to me is, we're supposed to be holding ourselves up to a high standard. So I'm not sure it really matters whether others do it too.
Meaning what though?
Meaning that fraternities can't really have it both ways. They say that they represent these high values of honor, and that they are somehow, you know, role models and leaders. And the data is clear that they drink more than others on campus. And so if you just then point to elsewhere and say, well, everybody else does it too, I'm not sure that that's even within the spirit of the fraternity movement.
Yeah. So, but you also said that you found, especially amongst national leadership, people who really want to get fraternities back on track here. But, I mean, drinking seems to be one of those things that sort of lays – I don't want to be overly critical, but it makes me a little dubious about their actual sincerity in that, because it's such an obvious problem, also one that's very difficult to control. Granted, but like, is part of the issue here that is there's only so much the national organizations can do, and that really the change has to happen from house to house on campuses?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, the nationals are relatively small, and it's very important that there be adults supervising the chapters, and alumni have to set an example. And I recommend in the book that there be adults living in the chapters. But there have been national fraternities that have taken a stand against alcohol and dramatically reduced the amount of drinking and dramatically reduced the sexual assaults and the hazing deaths. It's possible. It can be done. It's just it's a choice.
Yeah. Well, to that point, let's take a call from Mark, who's calling from Brighton. You're on the air, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was basically going to echo a lot of what Josh from Plymouth said. I was also a member of fraternity. I think that they get a lot of a bad rep because it's a large organization that a finger can be pointed at. It's the same issues that you talk about that fraternities deal with, sports teams deal with, as far as sexual assault, hazing, drinking. You put a large group of college students together, and a few of them are going to make bad decisions. And if there's a group, an organization that a finger can be pointed at, it looks better for the campus to do that and have some form of repercussion for these incidents. You can't have that for a dorm floor or a group of friends that won't make the headlines that the campus is going to need for a response to an incident like that.
So, Mark, I take your point, but I have a question, and it comes off something that John was just saying a minute ago. Can you really have it both ways? Because, I mean, just, you know, SAE specifically, this is also an organization that we're talking about. Its core creed is to craft true gentlemen who have a sense of propriety and self-control equal to all emergencies. So if that's what the fraternity is saying is at the heart of what it's supposed to teach young men, shouldn't higher expectations be made of it?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that point. The only thing that I can say to that was just,
Still with me, Mark? Oh, looks like we lost Mark, and I'm sorry about that, Mark, but I appreciate your call. John, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so interesting. I mean, you know, it is certainly true that the problems that fraternities face are problems throughout the college campus, but a lot of the argument, for instance, that, you can always pick out another group. Like sports teams also have huge problems with this. And in terms of hazing, for instance, the two biggest hazers on campus, research shows, are varsity sports teams and fraternities. So if you could compare yourself to the sports teams and say, well, we're about as bad as they are, you can compare yourself to the general population where there's less hazing. It sort of depends on your perspective. And I think the funny thing is I talked to a lot of national leaders, the national association that represents fraternities, and they acknowledge and believe that they have a problem. They believe that drinking is a problem. They want to do something about it, and they don't really point fingers and say that they're being, unfairly treated. At least in the book.
These are members who have graduated from college and they're deeper into their adulthood. One wonders if like the local chapter presidents are also feeling the same way.
Well, I think that the members, they don't have this long perspective. You know, you come in, you're a young guy, you want to have a good time, you want to have this group of friends. But it's important for parents and colleges to point out that there have been all these deaths and the hazing is a problem, and the kind of drinking that they're doing, the sort of underage bartending and unsupervised, and it has led to a lot of sexual assaults. And you know, it's just a fact.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Michael's calling from Worcester. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern in listening to this is that it seems like a big part that is not being made salient is that these aren't college students. These are males. And fraternities and sports teams are major institutions where there is a huge pressure on being a certain kind of man and where a certain kind of masculinity gets created, including a masculinity based upon misogyny, sexual domination of women, heavy drinking, taking physical risks, and so on. So from my perspective, unless we address those underlying issues, we're missing the thrust of what's causing this problem.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. John Hechinger, your response?
I mean, that's an excellent point. And in one of the chapters, I look at the history of hazing. And hazing was viewed as a way to enforce a certain kind of masculinity. And it's supposed to sort of weed out the weak, weed out people who ask questions, and privilege the older over the younger. And it's extremely dangerous. So, yes, I mean, I think that's an excellent point. And the fraternities themselves have to try to teach a different way forward. I should say that SAE took a step to ban pledging completely several years ago. Pledging is where most of the hazing happens. It's when you're a sort of provisional member and you're kind of easy pickings for the older guys. And since SAE did that, they haven't had any more deaths and their insurance losses have dramatically declined. So, yes, that's also an excellent point that the caller makes.
I mean, I have to say just a personal reaction to hearing how a very cold and clinical measure of the effectiveness of change is in the reduction of insurance losses gives me a bit of a chill. I want to get one more call in here. David's calling from Hyannis. You're on the air, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I almost pledged SAE at Dartmouth in the early 1990s, and I'm so glad I didn't. Back then, we had a very bookish college president. It was the first year he prohibited pledging fraternities in your freshman year. You had to wait until sophomore year to pledge fraternities. And it was a great benefit to me personally. It kept me from getting lost in that system. And it greatly, I thought, broke the back of the centrality of the Greek system in college life. And I thought it was very, very helpful.
Mm. David, thank you so much for your call. And Dartmouth SAE chapter is pretty notorious.
It's been shut down for hazing, and it has been at the center of a lot of controversy there. Dartmouth's really interesting example, though, because it's still a Greek stronghold. I think about half of male students belong to fraternities at Dartmouth. And the college is actually trying to provide alternatives, a different kind of social life, so that people don't feel like they have to join. And they're eliminating pledging and trying to lessen the influence of Greek culture.
So last couple questions for you, John. I mean, we kind of began by talking about the centrality of Greek life on especially large public university campuses. And I just wonder how we unwind the centrality, if that's even possible. And if I could just quickly, I want to quote from your book. You say that about 40% of U.S. presidents have belonged to fraternities, 39% of senators from the 113th U.S. Congress, a quarter of U.S. representatives, and one-third of all U.S. Supreme Court justices all belong to fraternities. Then you go and point out that in places like Indiana, the Indiana University Foundation says that Greeks that compose just 19% of their database of alumni made 60% of all donations. So to me, those are all very powerful indicators of a powerful and influential network that makes it seem like it would be impossible. And the members are loyal to each other. So how do we then, given that, begin to bridge that the chasm that we've been exploring all, you know, throughout the show?
Well, it's a challenge, but that's why I think you have to harness the sort of reform-minded impulses from within, and there has to be pressure from without. You were mentioning insurance, and the reason I talk a lot about insurance in the book is that loss of insurance is a huge problem for fraternities, as is litigation. So those are outside influences. That pressures fraternities that they have to take steps to make changes. So, and colleges need to try to sort of enforce a lot of these rules. And they're, you know, Penn State shut down much of its Greek-like life after this horrible hazing incident that's right. going to be leading to a trial. I think that you need pressure and regulation, and then you need to kind of harness the better impulses of a lot of the men in the fraternities who really do want change.
Mm. Because again, at the core of it, there is that organizational creed of the true gentleman. Well, John Hechinger, his new book is True Gentlemen, The Broken Promise of America's Fraternities. We just barely scratched the surface. This is an incredibly deeply researched book. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
And listeners, if you got some thoughts on fraternities and the good, the bad, the ugly, send them to us at our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Wednesday, which means Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, is in the house with us to talk sports.
I knew if I lived long enough, somebody would say
Littlefield's
that.
Littlefield's in the
regarding
house.
Regarding me.
He's
very,
here.
Thank
Hello,
you. That was
Bill.
Very cool.
All right.
Good to be here.
It's always good to have you, but let's start off with some, I don't know, bad news this morning that Red Sox manager John Farrell is out. Mm-hmm. News comes after a couple of days following the Sox elimination from the division series. They were ousted by the Astros, and we've got some tape here. Here's Red Sox president of operations, David Dombrowski, today.
After some thought processes, you weigh a lot of different things that become involved. And to me, I thought that it was the appropriate time to make a change for the betterment of the organization to move forward. And for me, I think at this point, sometimes change can be better.
Change can be better, Bill.
Yeah, and thought processes are always good things to engage in before you make a change.
So is this a good change that followed these
As
thought processes?
As I understand, processes? He said gobbledee followed by some gook.
Come on. I mean, they did. We, you know, it's funny. Week after week, we talk about managers who were ousted after a team has a not great season, but the Sox were 93-69
this
season.
Yes, they were. Frequently, the real reason for making a change after a team has had a reasonably good season, although with the Red Sox, it's always disappointing that they don't go even further. is that the old phrase, the managers lost control of the team. And there were a number of things that happened this year that would lead people to – invite people to draw that conclusion. You had the thing between David Price and Dennis Eckersley where Eckersley criticized a pitcher and Price said, blah, 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 you don't have any right to do that. You had Dustin Pedroia getting hurt and then a pitcher knocking down one of the Orioles and Pedroia mouthing to the Orioles, that wasn't my idea. And some people said, hey, what's he doing? You know, blaming his teammates, not taking responsibility when a pitcher was standing up for him. You had Nunez going back out onto the field on a knee that collapsed as soon as he went back onto the field. A lot of people said that was a pretty silly managerial decision. So these kinds of things may be part of what went into it. The fact is the people around here have developed very high expectations for the Red Sox. So losing early in the playoffs is not satisfactory.
Mm, okay, so to that point, yesterday we spoke with Herald sports columnist Steve Buckley, and he had written a column on Monday titled "Time Has Come for Red Sox to Fire John Farrell," and here's what he said.
A lot of times when a team wins a division title and goes out in the first round, it's still seen as a happy moment, a climb up. This is Boston. It's a high payroll. It's a team with annual expectations to go deep into the playoffs, if not win the World Series. So fighting a good fight, glass half filled, silver linings, none of that, unfortunately, applies to the Red Sox.
So those high expectations there that Steve Buckley was also talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, we should say that Farrell issued a statement today that included this. He said, "I'm grateful to an ownership group that gave me such a unique opportunity and one that shared my desire to bring World Series championships to this great city. They supported me through a challenging and scary period in my own life, and I remain forever indebted," talking there about the fact that he was diagnosed with lymphoma in 2015.
Right. And he's a class guy, and he's also a baseball man, and that's a way of saying to his next employer, "I won't say anything bad about you when you fire me either." That's how they go. I mean, baseball is famous for recycling guys. It is the ultimate old boys club, and he'll have a job somewhere before long.
So who's going to be recycled into the Red Sox then?
Well, my two suggestions are if Cleveland doesn't beat the Yankees, Terry Francona be available. He's pretty good. Had a pretty good run in Boston.
I know what I was going to say. I think we don't know a little bit about it.
And if Washington doesn't beat the Cubs, then maybe Dusty Baker will be available. And wouldn't it be nice to have a Dusty Baker manage the Red Sox? That would be a real change in complexion in the dugout, wouldn't it?
It would. So, yes. Okay. So here's the thing. I want to talk about soccer, and the link here is your your track record when it comes to prediction, okay? Because I want to start with some foreshadowing you gave us last week about the U.S. men's team. Cue the flashback harp.
The U.S. men's team is on the brink of failing to qualify for the World Cup next year. Boy, they better beat Panama on Friday night.
Aha! And so they did beat Panama, but then was last night's game against Trinidad and Tobago.
Long distance blast, and it's Alvin Jones! One for the legend books! Oh, my! His first Trinidadian goal! Well, retire right now.
Now, that was a pretty kick, but for the U.S. men's team, the shame, the horror, what happened?
Yeah, well, the simple answer is they lost to the worst team in the group. It's tough to play, traditionally tough to play on the other guy's field, but they were playing a team that is 90-something in the world. They should have won. And the longer view is that last night's performance was utterly representative of the way they have gone through this qualifying round. On one night, they can look terrific. They beat Panama by 4 goals not so long ago, just a few days ago. And then, bang, they fall on their faces against Trinidad Tobago. So, it was an awful thing. People are talking about this as the worst loss in the history of U.S. national team play. And by the way, it's the worst loss in the history of U.S. national team play by men.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I was like, say it, Bill.
Lots of women's teams have played
by
very
the men.
Well.
And, that's right.
And they have been upset, but not very often by other teams, and certainly not by one as low down the chart as Trinidad Tobago.
But I got to ask you something. As you know, there's been much wailing and gnashing of teeth over this loss and the whole, like, first time failing to qualify for the World Cup since 1986. Oh, boo-hoo, whoa-ho-ho. But is this really the setback that some soccer observers are seeing for soccer in the United States?
The worry that I have on that, Meghna, is that it might take the form of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It shouldn't,
because if you step back and take an objective view, what do you see? You see a professional men's league that's doing quite well, and that in fact in some cities is selling out, you know, drawing crowds of 50,000 people. You see a women's league which just won't die. I mean, they just keep coming back, and I saw some Breakers games this year and they were very entertaining. And of course you got youth soccer going crazy. Maybe this teaches the federation to start looking for some of those kids who've come from other countries and are playing on the playgrounds, and their parents can't afford the expensive opportunity to play on club teams.
Yeah.
Go watch them down on the playgrounds. Find that Messi from Argentina.
Right.
You know, find that kid who's coming from someplace in Ecuador or Honduras or someplace who's been playing great since he was 3.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. He joins us every Wednesdays here at Radio Boston. Thanks so much, Bill.
My pleasure, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.